Hello again, everybody. Welcome to the AMA podcast. My name is Matt Ruddock, your host. As always, thank you so much for downloading this week's episode. Well, the weather has turned. It is warmer than ever here at the International Air Modeling Center in Muncie, Indiana. And I don't know about you guys, but I know what that means. That means it's almost time for the Nats. As a matter of fact, as you're hearing this episode, the Nats have actually already started. The indoor Nats have already begun for the year. The outdoor Nats will be starting here in just a couple of weeks. And I thought, what better time to discuss the history of the National Air Modeling Championships than right now? And what better person to help me do that than our director of the National Model Aviation Museum, Mr. Michael Smith. Michael, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on. Always enjoy talking to individuals about the museum and about the history of air modeling. It's really a unique history that spans several hundred years, actually, now. So it's pretty interesting, and it's always fun to discuss, obviously, the side of competition, which isn't always, you know, the main point. We have a lot of people who sport fly who just enjoy that, but competition has always been a driving factor of the hobby, especially technology-wise. Airframes, engines, those are all things that have definitely been driven by competition that then, as with any other sport, you have the opportunity for that to kind of bleed over to the average modeler, and they get to enjoy the pieces that at a certain time were only available to the few. And then, you know, in a few years, you get some of that technology and you get to fly it yourself at your own field. So, yeah, always interesting to discuss competition.
Yeah, competition, like you said, it drives the technology side of things. And that's certainly been the case over the years, the many decades at this point in model aviation. Tell me, Michael, so, you know, I know competition within our hobby started before the Nats became a thing. So what can you tell me about kind of those early days of competing? What was what were things like? What were the airplanes like that these guys were flying?
Well, competition, it's pretty amazing because you think, okay, the Wright brothers tested their airplane in 1903. By 1905, at Huffman Prairie, they were flying circuits. They were flying figure eights, things like that. And by 1907, in England, you already have a model airplane contest. And it is, I believe it's the Lewis Adams Cup. And there was a fair amount of money that was offered to the winner. And it's interesting to note, and this also goes back to the tie between full scale and aviation that continues today. But the winner of that contest, although technically, because he didn't exactly meet some of the requirements, he actually didn't win, he came in second, but that was A.V. Rowe, and he used his winnings from that contest to build his first full-scale airplane and start the company Avro.
Oh,
so he flew a very interesting pusher airplane. There's some great pictures that you can find on the web of A.V. Rowe with holding his airplane aloft, getting ready to launch it. Yeah, competition, I mean, again, that was 1907, and the Wrights are, you know, flying in 1905. So, again, modeling was hand-in-hand right there with full-scale aviation. In this country, the first national event was actually in 1915. It was for the Villard Cup. That was slightly different, though, in that it was actually more geared towards clubs, and it was actually three different events. So basically what the club did was participate in the event, their club members, and generally a representative from a full-scale aero club acted kind of as a judge. And so I don't remember the exact order of this, but like the first event was rise off ground or ROG. The second event was hand launch. And the third event was ROW. Now, that's not might not be exactly the order, but each month was one of those. And they were scored, and their results were sent in to the NAA. And the winning club then, they posted, some of the different magazines would post the results from the contest, and then the winning club was awarded the trophy. And at that time, one of the predominant clubs in the United States, and I should say at that time, there were a number of different clubs. You had a club that formed by Lillian Todd. She formed a model airplane club in New York in 1909. So you had a number of model airplane clubs, but again, these were big city clubs. And so the Illinois Model Aero Club won in 1915. They won again in 1916. Because of World War One, the event wasn't held in 1917 or 1918. It was held again in 1919. And all 3 years, the Illinois Model Aero Club won. And so, as was customary at the time, you saw this with the Schneider Cup, other big events, things like that. If a country or a team or something like that won a trophy three times, it was retired to them. So the Illinois Model Aero Club, when they won the last event, they were tremendously excited, obviously. I mean, the club had some big names in it. Carl Goldberg was eventually, he was a member of the Illinois Model Aero Club, but there were other names that were well known at the time. But they were ecstatic that they won, but they were also so forward-thinking that they realized that the loss of a national contest actually hampered the growth of the hobby. So what the Illinois Model Aero Club did was they went to the NAA and tried to see about restarting or having a new national contest. Mm-hmm. Again, the Villard Cup had been for clubs. So there were several years that they thought they were going to be successful. They had difficulty in terms of sponsorship, in terms of a trophy, things like that. But finally, in 1922, it looked like everything was going to come to play and they were going to actually have an event. But towards the end, everything kind of fell apart. And so in 1923, they were really trying again. And what's amazing is that the Illinois Model Aero Club talked to the NAA, and the NAA basically said, well, if you can get it on to the event listing for the 1923 National Air Races, we can have a national contest. So the club was able to work with Bernard Mulvihill, and he agreed to put forth the money for a trophy. And he actually, there's some documentation where he actually contacted art schools on the East Coast to design a trophy. And there's really a neat trophy, a picture of one that was going to be a boy launching a model airplane. That was what the Mulvihill Trophy was going to look like. But for some reason, and I have been unable to find why the change, but the trophy ended up being Icarus tying on his wing. Mm-hmm. And we actually have that trophy here in the museum that the Mulvihill has evolved, but there's still a Mulvihill contest every year. And at the awarding of the winner, they come and retrieve the trophy, go out, and award the actual trophy, the Mulvihill, from 1923. And the winner's name is engraved on the base of it. But again, going back to the Illinois Model Aero Club, so they lined up Mulvihill to agree to put forth the money for the trophy. But how were they going to get it on the docket for the actual race? Well, the president of the full-scale Illinois Aero Club, he had an aircraft, a World War I bomber, that had been converted to a passenger airplane. So he lent that airplane to the, in essence, kids. And they flew with the pilot and the mechanic, and they flew from Chicago down to St. Louis and met with the air race board. And they were able to tell and show that, you know, they had the support of Bernard Mulvihill and everything. And so it became event number 6 at the St. Louis Air Races, and it was an individual event. So unlike the previous events, which had been, again, for clubs and had been multiple events, this was actually the very first national event where the contestants were all lined up and they were basically flying the exact same plane, and it was that individual flying that airplane.
And something that always strikes me is, because we've got this incredible exhibit here in the National Model Aviation Museum that kind of walks you through the history of the Nats, and there's a section about this on there, and there's an breathtaking poster that was made for that international air race in St. Louis that is just... It's one of those that when I see it, like, it inspires a lot of creativity in me. But, you know, reading through there and reading about some of the competitors that competed in that Mulva Hill. And as you mentioned, it's a competition that still goes on today. And it's a big deal when the Mulva Hill is played out here at the Nats and bringing that trophy out and kind of keeping that tradition alive. So that's a really cool thing for us, I think.
Yeah, it's an amazing trophy. I mean, the design of it is so forth is really neat. But its legacy, I mean, it was what, when we look at the Nats as they are today, that's where we trace the first Nats back to. We don't use the 1915 event because, again, it was clubs and it was multiple events. So for the Nats, we trace it back to 1923 as being the first Nats. And then obviously, as the hobby evolved, you had different disciplines emerge. You also have had different ways that judging occurred. And
well, yeah, because up until this point, I mean, we're still talking free flight. You know, we've not yet come into control line. We've not yet come into RC. So we're at this point, we're still in the kind of the world of free flight.
That's correct. And we're rubber band powered.
Right.
And we are judging for time aloft. Previously, when free flight was emerging, well, I should say when model aviation was emerging and people were looking at competing, generally the contests were for distance. And when they first started, they were flying in gymnasiums, armories, things like that. And they were trying to see how far the airplane would fly. And you might have a newspaper that said a record flight of 236 feet. For example, might be kind of the catch, or a world record of 800 feet, you know, was set. So that was initially what people were looking at in terms of contest. And so you had, in the early days, I mean, you had long measuring tapes that they were using. And then they went outside because they started to hit the walls.
Right.
And so they went outside and were flying in parks, or they were flying in... just open fields. And again, they were flying for distance, and you also started to have some contests where they were flying for speed, but it was straight line right. speed. And that's when they started to use surveyor wheels to measure. And then you start to have records that are 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet. And so the people who are competing, the people who are judging, the organizers, obviously they're looking at the hobby and how they can actually make this work. And they realize relatively quickly that, you know, if we have a contest and we have 40 kids or 40, you know, teenagers, whatever, you know, show up for airplanes and they're flying 3,000-4,000 feet, you know, that's going to be a troublesome thing trying to measure all these flights. And so then they start to look at duration. And so you have kind of that evolution, that change in airplanes, and you go to stopwatches, but again, you're in some cases they're chasing the airplanes. So as airplanes evolved, and then you put internal combustion engines on them, you know, they would load them full of fuel, and you could have flights that might be an hour. They'd be chasing them with bicycles, or you right. know, on their friends' cars, chasing these airplanes. And again, the
I've seen video. There is video footage of this. Or, well, it's not video; it's old film. I'm gonna get my. I should be the one to get that kind of terminology right. But anyway, I've seen some old film reels where you see these guys just hanging off the side of the car, and they're
just chasing the airplanes and watching where it drifts.
Yeah.
And again, the judges realized, well, you know, if we have, you know, 40, 80, because again, as competitions were going, I mean, they would have big turnouts and they would have a lot of spectators too yeah. that would show up, which was, you know, really cool. Again, everybody was interested in flight. It was new, it was exciting. But the judges realized that this wasn't going to work either. We can't have 80 airplanes and be chasing them for an hour or hour and a half right. to Timbuktu or back. So then they start to look at, you know, limiting fuel runs. and limiting flights, trying to keep things on the field so you know you have multiple heats or multiple sections of an event, things like that, where the modelers then try to max out, you know, those times, and then it's accumulated and so forth. So all of that kind of evolved as the airplanes got better, and that also changed the way the airplanes were designed, because originally the airplanes, again, we're talking free flight airplanes, even when they went to internal combustion engines, you're talking airplanes that were really relatively big, and the guys would hold a wingtip, they'd start the engines, and they would hold the wing